Welcome to the Pin Down, your Detroit Pistons podcast. I'm your host, Wes Davenport from Motor City Hoops and Detroit Bad Boys.
And I'm Blake Silverman, writer for Detroit Bad Boys, covering everything from the Pistons to the NBA draft and the Motor City Cruise.
Blake, let's just kind of dive right into it, because for all the excitement, right, that we had last week on the podcast after the flurry of moves that they made, and you know, the little bit of a winning streak that they had, and they followed that up with a really good, really nice game against the Clippers as well. So there was a lot of positivity going off, you know, in and around Pistons land, and well, it all kind of came crashing down, right? So you've got the two blowout losses to the Lakers, to the Suns. Those games were far, far less competitive than what the final score would have suggested. And of course, you know, we have to briefly mention the little dust up, right, that Isaiah Stewart had pregame with Drew Eubanks. We don't have a lot of information on that one yet, but you know, it does feel safe to say that it'll probably at least result in some level of a suspension. So that's not great. You know, we went from this kind of relative high for where this season's been to now kind of crashing all the way down to what feels like pretty close to the bottom yet again here as we transition into the All-Star break. So, you know, let's just start with the Lakers game. Blake, you know, from your perspective, what on earth went wrong in that first quarter?
Yeah, I feel like the Pistons really just got punched in the mouth and like were struggling to get back up and really didn't have an answer to it. I mean, when you're playing a team with like LeBron James, and I mean, man, like Rui Hachimura, like one thing I kind of wanted to get your perspective on was they were for sure targeting Simone Fontecchio, like, which I thought was interesting. And Rui was just kind of like going off in that first quarter. And then like the rest of the group kind of got roped in, and the Pistons could really never bounce back. And then, I mean, you go to the bench, like the bench looked okay, but like Marcus Sasser could not buy a bucket in that game, which was tough to see. I mean, really just like two stinkers in a row for the Pistons, which was tough. James Wiseman looked good against the Lakers, which was fun, but then he did not look good against the Suns. So overall, after that Lakers game, I was hoping they would bounce back and at least compete heading into the All-Star break. You want to go into it on a high note, but overall, I'm just hoping that there are a couple stinkers in a row that they can kind of just throw out of the door, take a few days, like a week off, whatever it is, and come back and really just get back to where we were at the Clippers game.
Yeah. So you bring up them targeting the Lakers, being them targeting Simone Fontecchio, and they did, right? They definitely did with Rui. I do, you know, I think it kind of gets into maybe an underrated, in a way, talking point here that should have came out of the Lakers game, and I'm not sure that it really did. But, you know, the Lakers game was one that, at least from my perspective, is a lot easier to write off as just, you know, hey, bad matchup, bad night. That Lakers team is a nightmare for what the Pistons have on the roster. They have two guards that can shoot the ball really well. They're both quick, and Reeves is a much better three-level scorer than I think he gets credit for. So they got two very talented guards. Their forwards are massive. Rui Hachimura, 6'8", 230. LeBron James, was he 6'9", 250? They're both massive. They can both handle the ball. They can both shoot it, and they're both decent rebounders. And then Anthony Davis is patrolling the paint. So in terms of how the Pistons match up on defense against that team, there's no, you know, there's no easy hole, I guess, to poke, right? They have no matchup advantages when they're guarding the Lakers. The Lakers are a nightmare for them. And then on the other end too, on offense, like the Lakers pack the paint, they're big, they rebound well, so the second chance buckets go away. And when the Pistons kind of went cold from three, that was the game. The Suns one is a little tougher to kind of just wave away, especially with Devin Booker getting ejected, the kind of wild way that the game began. It was out of hand from, you know, a refereeing perspective. Fouls were getting called everywhere. Tees were getting thrown all about. And, you know, the Pistons just, they didn't capitalize. At one point, it was 23-23. Next thing you look, they're down 30.
Yeah, I think it was a 24-2 run that Phoenix went on at that point.
And that's not their, that is not, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that is not the only 20-2 run that Phoenix went on.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not. Like, luckily there was garbage time where the Pistons could make the final score not look horrible. But like you said, like, it was really never close after that, like, first quarter run that Phoenix went on.
No, I mean, the lead at one point stretched, I think, to 38. I'm not sure it ever got to 40, but it was a 38-point game at one point early in the third quarter. That was just a disgusting game from a Pistons perspective. And of course, you know, entering into it, you get the news with Isaiah Stewart and the fear that he might miss even more time than maybe his injury is going to cause him to. So it was just a whole empty basket of nothing. There was just no good takeaway to come from that game. So because of that, I would like to focus more on the Lakers game, because I feel we could at least analyze some of the struggles that the Pistons did have there. So you bring up Simone Fontecchio, and I think with good reason. Let's just talk about the forward rotation in general, because Simone Fontecchio, he started the game cold from three. At the same time, he was the only guy the Lakers guarded from the three-point line. So, you know, if we're going to continue to see this pairing in the front court of Fontecchio and Ausar Thompson along with Jalen Duren, do you think this is a defense they're going to continue to encounter? Because both the Lakers and the Suns absolutely packed the paint. They just tagged Fontecchio out on the perimeter, made sure he always had a hand up on him, and everybody else they kind of left alone. No one else could make him pay for it either. So is this something that, you know, is going to keep popping up, or is there a way out? What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And I know, Wes, you brought it up on Twitter. Like, there have been a ton of issues, but one of the biggest issues that the Pistons have faced all season is just the amount of non-shooters they have on the floor at any given time. Like you mentioned with the starting lineup, like, you have Ausar in there and Jalen Duren in there. That's two non-shooters, clogs up the floor. And say even you, when Isaiah Stewart's back, you flip Ausar for Stu in the starting lineup. Like, yeah, Stu can be effective from the three-point line, but he doesn't get that same respect that, like, Fontecchio does or other, like, three-point shooting bigs. So I do think it's going to be an issue. I want to give Ausar a little credit, because he did make a three in that game. I mean, it sounds so sad to say, but he did. I think it was the first three of the game too. But where his shot is right now, like, he's not even going to be guarded on the three-point line, which really, like, makes things tough for the rest of the group. Like you were saying, like, Fontecchio has less space to find his shots and get things up. So, I mean, we know this season is long gone. So I'm hoping after the All-Star break, we do get some changes to these starting lineups, or at least, like, staggering some guys. So hopefully you only have, like, one non-shooter on the floor at all times next to Cade and Ivy to really, like, let them work.
Well, and I want to make clear here too, this isn't just a starting lineup problem, mm-hmm. All right? Because James Wiseman played significant minutes off the bench, both against the Lakers and against the Suns. And I got it a little bit against the Lakers, because the Lakers are bigger and Muscala struggles against more physical centers. So, like, I kind of got it, but at the same time, Ausar played a lot of minutes with the bench brigade as well. Like, he seemed to be the one guy that did kind of shift between both the starting lineup and some bench units that were out there. And, you know, to his credit, a lot of that probably has to do with he was having two very nice nights overall. Like, he played individually very well. The problem was he was playing with Duren, and then he was playing with Wiseman. Mm-hmm. And the issue just kind of compounded from there when Marcus Sasser off the bench couldn't hit water if he fell out of a boat. You saw Evan Fournier, who did play okay, I thought, in both games, but he's not the flamethrower he once was. And Troy Brown was a little bit cold too. Now, again, you know, that's two new guys. Fontecchio's new. There is going to be a ramp up period here. We haven't seen Grimes yet. I think what might be most frustrating, at least to me, is that when you look at the roster, even with Grimes out, it's very easy to structure things in a way that makes sense for spacing for Jaden Ivey and for Cade Cunningham. And there are multiple ways to do it too. It's not like when we were talking early in the season, there was one lineup that you could throw out there on the court that would have decent spacing and would let Cade Cunningham and Jaden Ivey work. Now that's not the case. There are quite a few that you could put out there and it would be effective, at least in that one narrow sense. And they didn't do it. They didn't do it in either game. And it really, really killed them against the Lakers. If you watch that game back, LeBron James, he plays free safety quite a bit. You know, his off-ball defense has gotten further and further away from his own man as he's continued to get older. He completely disregarded Ausar Thompson. Like, even with that tendency established, even if you kind of adjust how you're watching that game, how he guards Ausar, if you kind of adjust your expectations for how he tends to play defense off ball, he still completely ignored him. There were at least three or four times in the first quarter where Cade Cunningham couldn't even attack the free throw line, like the middle of the free throw line where he likes to get to in a pick and roll, because LeBron was just standing there. Ausar was in the corner. Like, he wasn't even playing the block. He was playing up. And it didn't matter because you also had Anthony Davis playing a drop coverage. So even if Ausar cut, right, he wasn't going to finish that shot. Anthony Davis was right there. And I guess this kind of gets to the problem of it all, at least to me, is this definitely hurts Ausar Thompson too. I know he played really well, and he did, but he did it in spite of this. He was doing it off, you know, quick hitters in transition, off rebounds, offensive rebounds that he got. Like, not much of this was generated in the half court, and he's not a great half court player. So when you put these restrictions on him because of the impact that he has with spacing when you put him next to another big, like, it does hurt his game as well. The best thing for him at this point is to play next to Stewart, to play next to Muscala, you know, Gallinari when he was on the roster. And the few minutes that he got with Muscala, he looked even better. You know, it was like a 2-minute stretch against the Suns, and all of a sudden he scored like 4 points in a row. You're like, ah, yeah, there you go. So, man, I've been rambling here, but go ahead, Blake. No, I can see you're ready to go. You got it.
Just kind of back to what you said about, like, LeBron guarding Ausar and him sort of playing up and really just, like, leaving Ausar in the corner with so much space in front of him. Like, in theory, that sounds good for a player like Ausar because he can just cut, be a lob threat, whatever. But like you said, you have the low man, Anthony Davis, that's there and is going to make things difficult. So, even though, like, in theory, Ausar should be able to have closer looks at the rim when he's being totally disregarded, like, the defense is accounting for that. So I agree. And, like, it sort of just makes Cade, Ivy, whoever is, like, initiating, like, I notice them being forced into a lot of, like, long twos, like, long mid-range shots, which are, like, the least effective shot in the NBA. Like, you want to get a clean look from three or something at the rim. And, like, that, we just weren't able to do that. And I think another, we were talking about Wiseman, like, Wiseman playing pretty good in that Lakers game, I feel like, kind of hindered what the Pistons did against Phoenix, because Monty Williams went to James Wiseman before he went to Mike Muscala. Muscala ended up getting more minutes because Wiseman wasn't really doing much, but I think if Wiseman
fouled out almost.
Yeah, like, I think if Wiseman, like, didn't have that, what he did against the Lakers, like, we wouldn't have seen him as heavy getting, like, as many minutes. But yeah, hopefully when Stewart gets back and there's different things that you can do in the front court, it helps up. But I agree, like, an ideal world, you need a floor spacing big who can at least sort of shoot the ball to play next to Asar Thompson.
Part of this, too, is that neither Cade Cunningham or Jaden Ivey are good shooters. They're okay shooters. Like, you're comfortable with both of them taking a volume of three-point shots. As a defense, you have to guard them at the three-point line. Like, no one's sagging off Jaden Ivey. No one's sagging off Cade Cunningham. So they're fine shooters, okay? But neither of them are good enough where you can get away with two complete non-shooters like Asar Thompson, Jalen Duren, James Wiseman, and Fontecchio as well, right? So there were times when Bojan was on the roster that you did see like Bojan just in Fontecchio's place, and it worked better, all right? And it worked better because Bojan is a much better shooter than Simone Fontecchio is at this career. Bojan can shoot it off the dribble. He could shoot it in isolation. He could do it off movement, which Fontecchio can as well. And he could also punish you if you play up too high. If you're only tagging him as a shooter, he can just go around you, get to the mid-range, get to the rim. Like, Bojan was a much more varied scorer and much better shooter than Fontecchio is, which is not a detriment to Simone Fontecchio necessarily. It's more just to say he's not good enough as a three-point shooter to be the only very good three-point shooter on the floor. If you slant all of your coverage to him, just leave your one guy on him at the three-point line, he's not going to punish that every time, and he's not good enough to shoot over it. Bojan was, right? So when the Lakers and the Suns did this, it really ruined the rest of this floor spacing, because he was the only like legit three-point threat. You felt okay, you know, being a little softer on Ivy and on Cunningham, and then just totally leaving Asar Thompson alone and totally leaving Duren alone from the hoop. So, you know, part of that is on Cunningham and Ivy. And I do want to add, when you were talking about the cutting with Asar Thompson, he's a very good cutter. When you constrict the floor, how they've been doing these past two games, your timing as a cutter has to be absolutely perfect. And there's such a minuscule window that you can really effectively, you know, get by your guy, get to the basket and finish and have it, you know, turn out the way that you want to, where he's just so young that it's unfair to even expect him to do that, as good of a cutter as he is. So like, there were windows against the Lakers, to be totally clear, there were windows where if he back cut, he probably would have gotten a layup, but it was like, you know, a split second of timing where if he did it right then, it would have worked, but he missed it. And then he started the cut and had to back out because he didn't hit it perfectly. Like, he's a rookie. Okay. We shouldn't be asking him to do that. It shouldn't be the expectation that he's perfect as a cutter right now. So yeah, I mean, I don't know why they aren't, but they need to make life easier for everybody. It's easier for Asar and Duren if they're playing next to spacers too.
Yeah. And it just all falls back to like that five spot or whoever the big is that you're rolling with. For me, like, I like when I watch the Orlando Magic and they have like Wendell Carter, who has the ability to go up to the perimeter, set a screen, and then just like sneak out to the perimeter. That opens the door for anyone else to cut towards the rim, or like for Franz Wagner to post up on someone. And like, that's just, I mean, Wendell Carter is a great three-point shooter, which is why they're able to do that. And that's just like not what Jalen Duren is. So I hope that, I mean, the short-term solution is like Mike Muscala sort of playing that role. I hope they get like some sort of backup big, or if Duren's the long-term starting five, like, I know he's been working on like putting the ball on the floor and initiating himself. I don't think he's ever going to be a shooter. So I think you need someone else that is on the bench that you can stagger in and maybe play next to an Asar Thompson that just makes things easier for them, like you mentioned.
Yeah. Well, and hey, Isaiah Stewart would be pretty good at that backup five spot. You know, just, that's not been talked about on this podcast before, so we're just going to leave that be. Let's dive into some questions here. We got two on Asar Thompson, actually, so I want to hit those first and just back to back. This one is from Kian Paras. Hopefully I said that right. But he says, It is really early, but Asar does seem like a younger Iguodala as projected, you know, in terms of questionable shooting, good defense, and he's a rookie. But could he get there with more dribbling, more playmaking? So I guess I want to bring this up as, do you think that he actually is kind of on that Andre Iguodala pathway that we thought he might be on early in the year and even into the summer? Or, you know, maybe do expectations need to start lowering? Where are you at right now with Asar going into the All-Star break?
Man, I'm just, like, really hopeful. Like, heading into, I guess, the draft process and everything, like, I didn't think, like, the shot for both him and Amen was the question mark. It still is. I didn't think it was going to be as big of an issue as it's, like, turned into, which makes me a little less hopeful that it can get to a level that maybe I thought he would be able to when he was going through that draft process. I mean, like we've said, he is still a rookie. Like, hopefully that's priority one over the summer and it improves a bit. I just don't know if it's ever going to get to, I guess, a good, like, I don't think it'll ever get to a great level, but can it get to, like, decent to good, so he's not just totally ignored? Like Kian brings up, like, Asar can play well in transition, and like we just mentioned, like, half court is still something that he's working on. I'm hoping those are something else that he can work on this summer. So while I still think that there's a lot of time, I think he might be a bit more hold into that, like, rim runner, defender, transition play, like, which, I mean, it's great to have a defender like him on your team. I just don't know if he, like, I highly doubt that he'll ever be a 3-and-D wing that is so, like, coveted in this league.
Yeah, you know, I think I agree with you, and, you know, naturally, I was much lower on Asar Thompson, at least coming in. He did change my mind, and I do still really like his potential. I'll say, though, that, you know, Andre Iguodala was a better offensive basketball player at this stage of his career than Asar Thompson is. Andre Iguodala had a better handle on the ball. And his jump shot, you know, I'm looking at it from his rookie year. It was on low attempts, but, you know, it was in the low 30s. He's only had a couple of years where he actually dipped under 30% from the three-point line. So in terms of just being an overall offensive weapon, you know, Andre Iguodala was a lot further ahead than Asar Thompson is right now. So I'm not sure that, you know, that level of offensive output is something that we're eventually going to get from Asar Thompson. And I think you're right. You know, he does kind of naturally fall into that dunker spot, roller, short roll kind of guy. What could change this is if his ball handling really tightens up. Right now, it's real loose. If he could fix that up, you know, kind of shore up that skill, maybe it unlocks some more things, at least as a driver and as a finisher. You know, that said, his touch around the rim's not great either. So, you know, I guess kind of a toss up there, right? If you improve your ball handling, he could get to the rim better. But then once he gets there, is he just going to, like, brand at night a bunch of finishes where he's going way too fast and the ball just ricochets off the backboard? I don't know. So, you know, I'm not sure that I would say the Iguodala comp is perfect, but he's still on that path. And I do still really like where he could get to. He's an elite defensive prospect at this stage. He's doing things as a defender, as a rookie, that not a lot of rookies ever figure out, you know, at any point in their career. His off-ball awareness is really good. I've been very impressed with him on that end. I've been impressed with him overall, too. So, you know, I think this is going to end up being more a question of, do they try to structure these rotations to cover for his weaknesses a little bit more? Or are they going to be content to just continue to throw him out there and, you know, hey, you got to figure it out, kid, because if you don't, we're screwed. I could see the logic behind doing that. I wouldn't personally, I'd like to move him to the bench, even now with Stewart injured. But, you know, what are your thoughts on in 3 years? So when his rookie contract ends, what type of offensive player do you reasonably think he could become by then? I mean, you've put in a lot more hours than I have watching his tape, watching his film, right? So where do you think this reasonably could end up in a couple of years?
Yeah, I think, I mean, ignoring the shot, because I think that's the biggest hole or like variable, I guess, like great player in transition, pair that with his defense, like that gets things going quickly on the offensive end. We talked about his finishing at the rim. I think as he gets into year two and year three, that's something else that would only go up. He's not great at generating contact right now, but like he does, and in theory should only get better, and hopefully he gets a better whistle as he goes into year two and year three and beyond that. So honestly, I just see him as a guy who can be in that dunker spot, hopefully with the proper people around him, just make things happen. And I think he could get to like a very good player at the rim just because of his size and his athleticism. And hopefully I'm worried to even say it, but hopefully the shot gets better and can just like enable more of his game. But that's really the thing that has been tough so far. So hopefully on offense, he can do everything else. He'll never be a primary or I don't think a secondary scorer, but hopefully a guy that you can have on the wing that can at least make plays and finish at the rim, just to have like someone else on the team who can score.
All right, so we're talking about development here with Tassar Thompson. Let's jump into this question from our guy Doug McMiniman. He says, hey guys, is Tassar Thompson's development as a competent shooter the single most important offseason item for him on his to-do list? What do you think?
On Tassar, yeah, I would say yes. I mean, I don't really know. Like, I'm sure it is a top priority right now, but having a full summer with 1 year of being in the NBA under your belt, like, I think it has to be a top priority. And whoever in the on the coaching staff, like, needs to work with him. I'm not really sure if it's even like a confidence thing at this point. But yeah, like bottom line for me, for Tassar Thompson, like the shot needs to be addressed. Like he just can't be being ignored on the 3-point line. Like he is, he has to be able to at least like he gets the cleanest looks ever because of how his shot is. And he needs to like, at least make defenders like think twice about him, whether it's in the mid range or on the perimeter. So I would definitely say it's priority one. Another thing, like you mentioned, Wes, is the handle too, but really I think the shot needs a lot of work, so it has to be addressed.
Yeah. So the shot obviously needs a lot of work. So for the sake of interesting conversation, I'm going to say, let's look at the ball handling. And I do think you can make a really compelling argument for it, right? If Tassar Thompson was able to really punish people on a drive in the half court, that would help to alleviate this a little bit. Look at how Jaden Ivey was guarded early in the year when he had a stretch there. He wasn't shooting fantastic on open catch and shoot shots, right? So teams were starting to leave him a little bit more, but they really couldn't go, you know, totally free safety and just completely ignore him on that end, because he was so fast that if he got the ball and you gave him a clean first step, he was already in the air and finishing a layup. Tassar Thompson has a lot of that quick twitch in him as well. He's not as fast in the straight line as Jaden Ivey, but he can jump higher, so he doesn't need to get as close to the rim in order to kind of have the same effect. So if he could really tighten up his handle, you have another method of, you know, hey, a guy's really sagging off, they don't have to close out. You know, if they're still way back there, you just gave him a runway. Look at Giannis really, really early in his career, right? When he absolutely had no jump shot, no mid-range whatsoever, you still couldn't sag off of him because you gave him a runway. LeBron James was a little bit the same way early on, right? If you give these guys a head of steam, they were so talented with the ball in their hands because their handle was so tight, they were so athletic that, you know, you were screwed. So you did still have to play up on them a little bit off the ball just in case they got it. So it's at least another option, right, for Asar Thompson. If he really improves the handle, if he really does get, you know, better in that area of the game where he can start punishing other teams off a live dribble in the half court, not in the transition, it helps some of the spacing issues. It doesn't alleviate them. I still would not want to be playing him next to a James Wiseman or a Jalen Duren for large quantities of minutes, but it does at least kind of mitigate the impact. And while we're talking about it, you know, we're going back and forth on the handle of the jump shot. Our guy Base Pistons here on Twitter, he asks, true or false, at this time, Asar's handle is more limiting to his game than his jump shot. That would be a spicy take. What do you think?
I'm going to say false. Like, I wouldn't be mad at the saying true because, like, I mean, tightening up that handle, like you mentioned, could definitely unlock other things. But I just, yeah, like, what the volume and I guess just like the accuracy that he's shooting with will always be what limits his game until it changes. And I guess, like we've been saying really this whole podcast, it limits like who you can play around him, like how better he's making the rest of his teammates. So I'm just like gonna fall back to like the shot is always gonna be the biggest hindrance to his game until it's addressed, but I wouldn't be mad at saying it was the handle as well.
I'm going to take more of a middle ground. I think, you know, long term, as long as there's going to be a Jalen Duren on the roster, which I think you could pretty safely say there is, it's much more limiting to his game in the role that he can have on this Pistons team. Now, if we're just specifically looking at him, right, how he plays, how he scores, his game on offense. If you put him in a lineup where he's the only non-shooter, you know, kind of like what you'd want to do with Jalen Duren right now, but instead it's just at the four spot and instead of the five with Asar Thompson there playing power forward. If you set up a lineup in that way, he could be very, very good if he had a good handle on the ball. Because you could legitimately play five out, have four guys that could handle a pick and roll, handle a DHO, at least three guys who could really set a traditional ball screen, plus your two guards that could invert. Asar Thompson with a ball, you know, with a better ball handling ability is a terror in the short roll on a five out offense. It would open up a lot of really fun and creative things that Monty Williams could do, that the team could do, if you play a floor spacing five with an Asar Thompson who has a very tight handle on the ball. Because again, right, part of the thing that is limited by his ball handling is his playmaking right now. You know, we'll see him, you could see him process the read. He's throwing the pass late though, because the ball's getting back to his hands slower, or he's not confident in the ball handling, or sometimes he's looking up and he's got to look back down so he doesn't lose the ball, and then he misses a guy, right? His court vision's really good. So if his ball handling's better, then that gets unlocked a little bit as well. All this is to say, you know, I think for this Pistons team, for the role that he has and hopefully needs to have going forwards, he's going to need to fix his jump shot. If you could wave a magic wand and get a center that starts and plays, you know, fully on the perimeter, blocks some shots and rebounds the basketball. You know, I guess blocking shots 50-50, you may not need that. But just offensively, if a guy's going to shoot and he could rebound so he could play out on the perimeter at the five spot, it might be a little bit more potent, especially just with him specifically. So That's my yes and no answer. It's true and false. It's the best way.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll say on like the handle thing is like having just like a loose handle is kind of a common, I guess, hole in a lot of prospects games, whether they're like rookies or guys who like draft prospects. So to me, also another thing when I'm thinking about it is like I have a bit more optimism that that's something that he can clean up after year one or in year two or whenever it comes around. I hope the shot is the same, but I'm just not as like confident or optimistic in that where we stand right now.
See, I'll take that to an extreme because I'm very confident that in the next couple of years, his ball handling is going to get a lot better. He flashes a few dribble moves every now and then that really looks nice, especially that spin move, right? He's really, really close. Mm-hmm. He's got a great spin move. His problem is he just doesn't put the ball back on the floor after he spins. Well, you know, it's a small little thing, right? It's just the confidence with the ball in your hands. I have no doubt that that stuff's going to come around. He explores that area of his game so much, it would be a shock if it didn't come around. The jump shot, he's shooting 15% from three. And he doesn't shoot a good free throw percentage either. I have no faith that that thing's getting over 30 anytime in the near future.
Yeah, that is very fair.
This one here is from Big Cheese. He wants us to straw man Monty Williams and Dwayne Casey's because he did it too. Rationale for those all bench lineups that we see. Usually we see them at the end of the first quarters. Occasionally it dips into the beginning of the fourth quarter as well as he transitions to the bench late in the third. So what's kind of what's the reason you think that he goes to these so frequently?
Yeah, I was trying to, figure this out when thinking through the Suns game earlier. Honestly, I think it just has to be him. I don't want to say it because we've seen this as an issue the whole season, but now when you have really like a fully turned over roster, I think he's also just trying to find minutes for some guys. And like, how do you do that? Like when someone goes on the floor, someone has to come off. And I mean, he played like, 11 guys in the first quarter yesterday. And I think he has been rewarding guys if they do have a good showing with like more minutes or at least giving them some run in the next game. We saw that against Phoenix with James Wiseman after his game in LA. So that's really like the only reasoning I can make is just like trying to get a handle on this new roster, seeing what sticks. The unfortunate part of it is like Quentin Grimes is, we haven't seen him yet. Stewart has been out and probably will be out for a decent amount of time. So I don't think we're going to have a game where Monty can play with like his fully healthy roster and try to figure things out for potentially a while. So I think we may unfortunately see that. And also another thing is like the bench played decently good against, or at least like better than the starters. So the all bench lineups have been an issue, but I think it might just like throw him for a loop when they're more effective than the starters. So in general, I'm really just hoping it's trying to figure out this full roster. I think it's a hard situation, but hopefully as we get like a few more games and after the All-Star break under the belt with this fully new roster, we'll start to see some guys like be at the back of the rotation and run more of that like 9 to 10 man rotation like we've all been hoping for.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, this absolutely could be a situation where, look, they're heading into the All-Star break. They didn't have a lot of practice time and coach just wants to say, hey, let's get a look at Evan Fournier. Let's get a look at Shake Milton, Troy Brown, all these new pieces that we brought in that are, you know, maybe coin tosses at this point, if they're actually going to get solid minutes as we close down the end of the season. Let's just get a look at them now. You know, we're playing the Lakers, the Suns. It would be a stretch to win that game anyway. And we're going into a period where we're going to get a week off with minimal practice time in there. So That absolutely could be the situation. I would say, like, from a basketball sense, though, if you qualify it by saying you have the players to pull that off, right, where it works, where the all-bench lineup is actually pretty solid and at least plays at a neutral level when they're out there together. You know, they don't make up ground, but they don't lose it either. You have a tremendous advantage because your starters get a little bit more rest. When you don't have to stagger, you get longer periods of break for, you know, the unit of your best players that you want out on the court to close the game. Dwayne Casey, you know, he did that when he was in Detroit to very little success, but in Toronto, he would routinely play a 10-man rotation, and their bench was so good at the time that it would win them games, right? This was when Fred VanVleet was coming off the bench. Like, they were killers. They were great. That team, when you threw out the 5-man bench unit, you know, sometimes it was a relief, right? So it's a tremendous advantage if you have the players to do it. I'm not sure, and I think you probably would agree, that the Pistons have the players to actually pull that off right now. That being said, there have been plenty of games this season after that 28-game losing streak where the bench won him the game. I mean, even look at the Lakers game, right, where I think he did play 11 in the first quarter. He went to the bench early because the starters didn't have it. The starters went down double digits, and the bench leveled it out there for a little bit. In fact, the lead got worse once the bench sat down and the starters came back in. Now, I ascribe a lot of that to the spacing things that we've already talked to, but the ball definitely moved better with the bench. And the ball did move better with the bench, too, against the Suns. They just weren't hitting their shots. So, you know, I would say the limiter here is more players than it is strategy, because if you do eventually get to a point where you can trot out a 5-man bench unit and not have them lose you the game, it's a huge advantage, Like, you imagine Cade, you know, coming in with, you know, if he leaves the game and it's a tie game and the all bench unit shows up and he returns with 8 minutes to go and it's still a tie game instead of being down 15. Whoa, right? Game changer. Yeah. So that's what he's going for. It's just they don't have the horses.
Right, yeah. And even if you could just stagger, like, one of Cade or Ivy with the bench, like what you see a lot of good teams do is, like, play their star player with their bench unit, and that's killed the Pistons a bunch this year. So even if you get to a point where you can do that, I think it'll go a long way. And hopefully once Stewart and Grimes are back, it just allows us to tighten up the rotations in general.
Well, and let's be clear, right? They do stagger. They just don't stagger dramatically. Mm-hmm. So what you tend to see is the bench trickles in. Cade's usually the last one to come out. So there are periods of time where he's the only guy out there with an all-bench unit. Jaden Ivey is usually, you know, somewhere in the middle there in terms of, like, pecking order that comes out of the game. But Cade also plays the most minutes, right? So it kind of makes sense. He's usually the first one that comes back in too. So you do. Point is, you do get periods of time where it's Cade and it's the all-bench unit with the other four guys. And, you know, maybe we're not seeing that as much as we'd like to. But it's not like they don't do it. They do it. So yeah. He's not platooning, right? It just, you know, you get to a point there at the end of the first quarter where the rotation's kind of filtered through, and now you have, you know, Sasser, Fournier, Troy Brown, Mike Muscala, James Wiseman, and it's kind of gross for now, for lack of a better word. Let's jump onto this one here. Also kind of talking rotations. This is Michael Robbins in the DBB comments. He says, so we have 6 guards, 4 forwards, and 4 centers. Would playing Cade Cunningham as a small forward allow for someone like Shake Milton to get rotation minutes?
Yeah, so I don't think, I mean, in this day and age of positionless basketball, like, I don't think Cade will ever technically be the small forward out there. Like, I think he'll always be playing as a guard. But, like, the thing is, like Michael brings up here, his size and frame sort of maybe allows us to play 2 guards next to him. And if someone like Shake Milton is shooting the heck out of the ball, like maybe that does make sense. I mean, there are defensive question marks with that, definitely. And I think there is also an element of it that when you are playing like two, I don't want to say smaller guards, but smaller players next to Cade, it puts more of the onus on Cade defensively. And I just see, like we just talked about, all the minutes and just like the high usage role that he's playing. I don't want him to have like a huge defensive like burden on his shoulders, because he really needs to be what the offense is flowing through on the other end. So I think that's the thought of playing like Cade and Ivy as your guards, and hopefully have a couple like floor spacing wings and ideally a floor spacing big next to him. But in short, I do think that like Cade's size in theory could allow you to play like a smaller guard alongside him and next to Jaden Ivey as well.
I think the thing to me with Cade at the small forward, which you kind of brought up, right, with it on defense, you know, he's guarding someone bigger, sometimes that may be a better player, a more threatening offensive player, I should say. The thing is, you know, at least in the short term for the rest of this season, because I agree, you know, in an ideal world, right, Cade's big advantage is that he is a massive point guard. So you could get a very big lineup and have it function really well if you basically have Cade Cunningham and, you know, three wings. That could be huge. I mean, you kind of look at what Orlando does a little bit with some of the larger lineups that they get to play, because, you know, they have a couple of big guards that can really leverage that. So Cade can be leveraged in that way as well. But, you know, right now they don't have the roster to do it. And Cade guards a lot of forwards already. There are plenty of games. I mean, Phoenix, actually. Yeah, there were a few possessions where he was guarding Devin Booker early, but he also checked Royce O'Neal most of the second half. What they tend to do is, Cade's not an amazing defender. He needs to get better on that end. And there are nights where it's looking like he might just not have it that night, and they shift him up and they hide him. So sometimes that's hiding him on a two. Sometimes it's hiding him on a three. They've put him on a couple of smaller power forwards in the past as well. So it's kind of softened me on my concern, because I was really worried about it, you know, having him guard larger, more physical players. He's already doing it, and they're intentionally doing it so that he doesn't have to guard, you know, Damian Lillard, right? Instead, they're putting him on, whoever the shooting guard is that they have there in Milwaukee. That's not Chris Middleton, and I can't remember his name. But point is, they're already playing him up in this way where, yeah, you know, if you want to start another guard next to Jaden Ivey so that you could get another shooter out there so that maybe you could have better perimeter defense and just bank on most nights, Cade, you're going to guard the three and it's going to be Royce O'Neal. Like, that'll probably end up being okay. Yes. Yeah. Beasley for Milwaukee was who I was thinking of. So they're already doing it. I'm kind of like, what's the harm for the last 20-something games for the end of the year? But hey, while we're talking about it, we've gotten a couple of questions with Quentin Grimes, hopefully coming back here after the All-Star break. He's dealing with a knee sprain. Didn't seem like a serious issue, so, you know, hopefully he'll be back soon. But when he does come back, do you think it'd be a good idea to start him next to Simone Fontecchio there on the wings, which would very much put them in this position where most nights Cade Cunningham's probably guarding a small forward?
Yeah, and Steve T also brought it up in the YouTube chat, so shout out to Steve. But I would definitely start Grimes next to Fontecchio, and the lineup that Steve brought up was Cade, Ivy, Grimes, Fontecchio, and Durin. That's where I am leaning right now. At least see if it works. And like Grimes and Fontecchio, yes, we know that Quentin Grimes has went through a bit of a shooting regression this year, and we want to monitor that when he comes back. But they're both like the 3-and-D wings that we really wanted and have been clamoring for that we went out and got at the deadline. We spent all that time talking about how Asar Thompson and his shooting and scoring sort of minimizes this starting group on the floor. I think if you have like Grimes and Fontecchio there, like two guys who like on paper can shoot, I think that'll help overall. And this lineup here, like we've also been talking about, just has one non-shooter on the floor in Jalen Duren. So I think we made like Grimes and Fontecchio were the stars of all of our trade deadline moves. So I think you would be doing a disservice to the players, the group, the fans, really everyone, if you don't at least try it. Maybe it doesn't work, but in theory, in my mind, that is what I'm leaning towards right now.
Well, it should work. It should work in theory. The thing with Quentin Grimes is that he's a very physical defender. He's not the biggest guy, but you know, he's 6'4", 6'5", somewhere in that range. He's got a good base to him, and he plays physical basketball as a defender. So the Knicks last season and when he played this year, they would have him guard forwards pretty routinely. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't having him check LeBron James, but he guarded Chris Middleton. You know, he guarded that class of small forward that's a little bit more of a finesse player, and he got up under him and he made an impact with it. So, like, I don't think that if you go this route, right, with Grimes and Fontecchio there on the wing, that you have to stick Cade Cunningham on the small forward. I think most nights it's a pretty safe bet that Quentin Grimes could guard 1 through 3, and what it gives you the flexibility to then do is put him on the most threatening, you know, perimeter threat on the other team, right? So if that's a Damian Lillard and you're playing Milwaukee, maybe you want to put Quentin Grimes on Lillard instead of Jaden Ivey. You know, maybe you'd want to do that against the Suns we just saw. You know, instead of Cade checking Devin Booker there in the first quarter, it would have been Quentin Grimes. Like, it lets you be flexible about where you have these guys guard, and lets you, if you want, hide Cade Cunningham a little bit more. Because again, right, Fontecchio is a pretty good defender. He's not a phenomenal defender by any means, but he's good. He's good enough as long as he's not guarding someone that's 235 pounds and is going to post him up every night, which, you know, shocker, is not most power forwards in the NBA these days. If you run into that issue, right, you're, again, my head's on Milwaukee for some reason. Like, yeah, Isaiah Stewart should start so he could guard Giannis. But, like, if you're playing Washington, yeah, Fontecchio can check Kuzma. Like, yeah, it's no problem. That'd be fine. So I really like the flexibility in this lineup, and I do really hope that they do it, even though it's a little bit smaller. Oddly enough, even with it being smaller, I think that's a better defensive lineup than what they're throwing out most nights. So yeah, I'd take it. They could all shoot at least.
Yeah, and like I mean, you nailed it with Grimes. The question mark, like, we know he's a good defender, but the question is, like, is he going to be able to guard those like big forwards? Like, I don't think you really want to do that. But he can guard like those lead, like star guards, like you're talking about Dame, like an SGA, a Trey. And that, I guess, just helps not having Cade or Ivy on those assignments. Like I think Grimes could lock one of those dudes up on any given night. So I think you at least have to try it. Like you said, it might be a little bit matchup dependent as they're figuring it out, but I think it can work.
Me too, obviously. So, all right, let's close it out on this question. I'm going to kind of Frankenstein two separate questions together because we got one from Black Swan in the DBB comments, and then as well here, one just from Doug McMinniman talking about the offseason. So Doug asks, what are your three most impactful offseason priorities? He says for him, it'd be getting another forward, focusing on Asar Thompson, presumably his jump shot, and then, you know, hopefully another very good free agent pickup. And Black Swan mentioned in the comments Tobias Harris. He doesn't want to overpay Tobias Harris, but also seems to be targeting that forward spot, thinking maybe, you know, a John Collins type that might be cheaper and a little bit younger. So, you know, to this kind of offseason question, where would you want the Pistons to go with all of this cap space that they're going to have now after the deadline?
Yeah, and thinking back towards like a top three, like I think Doug is definitely right in prioritizing the forward spot. And we heard those names like Tobias Harris and John Collins, and we want to know how we're going to use all this cap space. I think it has to be getting a guy like that. Not saying it's one of those guys, but in that archetype, depending on how the draft lands up, maybe you get that additional wing through the draft. I think even if that's the case, you also try and go out and get someone that could play around Cade and Ivy and Fontecchio and Durin and everyone just more immediately. And on top of that, I think you also still really need to address that like backup center spot if it's not going to be Isaiah Stewart. Like James Wiseman isn't a good defender. We like Muscala isn't a great defender. We don't know what's going to happen with him even. We don't know if we're going to retain him. So I think you go out and get a defensive minded backup big that can really like come in there and not make that such a hole like it has been immediately. And yeah, Doug also mentions Asar. I think we've talked about just prioritizing his development. I think that's a big thing too. But overall for me, it's getting another wing. We know that that's what's going to round out this roster, trying to address a backup big, and just like, how are we going to use all this cap space that we have worked so hard to open up?
For me, you know, I think you bring up that backup big spot. I think he's already on the roster. I think you need to be doing whatever you can this offseason to force Isaiah Stewart into the backup five position, no matter what. He's perfect. He's a great fit next to Asar Thompson, even, because Asar Thompson's a very good shot blocker, right? And he's incredibly athletic. So if you look at them as a 4-5 pairing, Isaiah Stewart can shoot, he can rebound, and Asar Thompson can block shots, get steals, and just go be an athlete on both ends of the floor. So that'd be perfect. I would love that off the bench. I think you're absolutely right. You know, Doug, you as well, and Black Swan too. Like, they need a forward, and I want them to double dip, maybe even triple dip. Get a forward in the draft with your top five pick that you're going to have. Sign one, and then trade for one. I think that honestly, the cap space that they have is probably more important, for lack of a better word, in the trade market than in free agency. This free agent class is not amazing, and the really high level guys that are there and that will be available, you'd have to convince them to come to a very poor Detroit Pistons team. You know, I mean, there's only so much money that you could really throw around. So, you know, in the offseason, the salary restrictions that you're exchanging over trades, they really loosen up. And I think that's probably where you see the biggest splash move made. I'm hoping that that's out on the wing, whether that be, you know, a kind of a combo 3-2 or a 3-4. Anyone, right? And you know, just really quickly, Fontecchio lets you be really, really flexible here, because you could probably pencil him in at either forward spot as a starter next season. He's going to get some of this available cap space when they re-sign him as a restricted free agent. But he's flexible enough that you don't have to get a, you know, combo forward who's more of a four. You could get another three, and it would work. It would be just fine. So they have a lot of options, and I would really expect it to be more so explored in the trade market than in free agency at this point.
Yep, definitely. You want another wing who can shoot and defend. The tough thing is that's what everyone in the league wants. So I'm hoping that, like you mentioned, they can get someone through the trade, also through the draft, ideally. And just like address that. That's been an issue all season.
All right, guys, we're going to wrap this one up. Thanks for tuning in. Blake, take it away, man.
Yeah, special thank you to Sean Corp, managing editor of Detroit Bad Boys, for supporting the show. And shout out to you guys for all the great questions and talking points tonight. We'll catch you all next week. Enjoy your All-Star break. Quick week off that we have from Pistons basketball. So whether we catch you again on your commute or live with us here on YouTube or Twitter, we can't wait to talk more Detroit basketball with you all.